Hey, what's up, guys? This is Deion Brown, and you are watching and or listening to the Man vs. Brand podcast. I want to talk to you guys a bit about loyalty. It's something that, as entrepreneurs, we tend to think of when we think about customers. But really, when we dissect loyalty as a whole, it's something that you really have to role play in your own life. You have to be your own contributor of loyalty, loyalty to your staff, to your partners, to your friends, to your network, to your relationships. If you're not loyal, how do you then expect others to be loyal to you? Now, we also exist in a space as entrepreneurs where marketplaces exist, right? The Amazons, the Etsy's, the Artfire at one point, but not so much, Poshmark. Right, there's so many players out there, and for a lot of them, it's consumer to consumer. Others are B2C or business consumer. And a lot of those people are loyal to the marketplace, not to the person or to the brand. They don't really think about you. They think, how can I find what I need and you provide it? It's like real estate, right? The difference between the rental agent and the agent that actually sold you your house, that whole relationship probably felt different for you. The rental person was just showing you the apartment you wanted to see. The person that sold you your home was really invested in your dream. Now, all you rental agents, I'm not saying that's how you are. I'm just talking across the board. Broad generalization. Don't be offended. All right? Some of you are awesome. But it goes to say that loyalty isn't something that we should just expect. Not in our personal relationships, and for sure not in our professional relationships. We need to ensure that there is some level of emotional and communication transaction happening there. I need to love you as a customer. You need to love me as a brand or a provider. I need to talk to you as a person. You need to understand my value as a provider or a brand. And if what we're doing isn't dialoguing, if what we're doing isn't sharing, if you don't understand the love language of your customer base, then you're probably struggling in other spaces in your relationships too. Because the same type of investment, the same type of thought, the same type of listening that it takes, whether it's metrics or sales, or conversations over the phone, or dinners, that it takes to maintain a healthy relationship, you're going to find it's a lot of similarities. So I'm here with Leslie Hensel, and she's going to talk to you about the work that she does. Now, she's been cited for her work in Amazon, being an Amazon retailer, right? But what I think is more important is that she really has a few talking points about family, about being your best self as an entrepreneur, and then about also killing it at Amazon. So we're going to talk to her about what she does at Riverbend Consulting, but more importantly, we're going to talk about customer loyalty, because I believe you can't actually have a conversation about doing well at Amazon if you're not having a conversation about what does it take to truly, truly learn your audience, connect with your audience, and inevitably own your audience. Not own them in the way that you control their behavior, but own them like a person does that owns something that is cherished by them, that they want to keep forever, that they want to travel with them wherever they go. How do you earn ownership over that customer body? All right, guys. So I want you guys to enjoy the conversation we're about to have.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
One of the greatest philosophers of our time once said that when it's up, then it's stuck. Find out how to make your next big idea stick with Deion Brown and his podcast. With 20 years of experience in growing and managing businesses and brands at the highest level, Deion is having the conversations that you are looking for. Welcome and have a great time.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Amazon. We're going to talk about family. We're going to talk about a whole lot on this podcast. So let me introduce you guys to Leslie. Leslie, how are you?
Hey, Dion. I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on. And what a great introduction to some really fun topics today.
Absolutely. I'm glad to have you. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast and for sharing with us what we will discuss. So talk to me, like, how did you get involved with marketplaces? I'm going to assume maybe Amazon might not have been your start. So how did you get involved in e-commerce and more specifically in marketplaces?
So I am one of those old school stories that you hear about the mom who has a problem, for real. So I've been a small business consultant for 20, 25 years. It's what I've always done. Marketing consulting for small businesses, done operational consulting, some PR, all the things. But then I came to a time in my life, I've got two little boys. They're not little anymore. But when we're talking about, I had two little
boys. They're little to you forever, right? Like, that's okay.
I look up at both of them now, but yes, little to me forever. And at the time, they were little, and I had one who was diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum, had dysgraphia, dyspraxia, all these disabilities and challenges. And my husband and I were really at a loss. He just could not succeed in school. And I had to figure out something to do because we decided we were going to homeschool him, but we didn't really homeschool. We did a whole lot of therapy, all the kinds of therapy. So how do you go from being someone who works a lot of hours one-on-one with clients to someone who is homeschooling a kid who needs a ton of attention? And Amazon was really my family's solution. We started selling on Amazon. My husband would work all day. He'd come home in the evening. I would find inventory, set up our listings. And on the weekend, we would ship all the product to FBA. And we did that for a few years until my kiddo was ready to go back to a traditional school. And Amazon really saved our family in that way. It provided this great opportunity for us to focus on what we needed to. And if you talk to, if you go to like an Amazon conference and talk to a bunch of sellers in the room, you will find so many people just like me who had a very real family problem. And Amazon and eBay and selling online was the solution. It's really fantastic. It provides so much opportunity for people to be flexible. So after my kiddo was back in school, I still sell online to this day. That was, oh gosh, almost 12 years ago. But after that, I started doing consulting for Amazon sellers because there was so much opportunity in that space.
So let's kind of backtrack a bit, right? Because what I hear in your story is you had been really solid at doing one-on-ones with your clients, solving client solution. I imagine solving complex client solutions, right? In a multi-discipline sort of area, right? So you mentioned PR, operations, right? General business. And then you realize that you're gonna become a one-on-one for your son, right? You're gonna be that type of coach that you've now been for your clients, except you have one now. You have this one person who all of your years of expertise, of understanding communication, of understanding conflict resolution, on presenting information using different learning models, everything that you've been talking to everyone else about, you now had to utilize it, and you had to utilize it for someone that you were deeply, deeply invested in, right? Like invested in this person succeeding, right? So the moment that you determined that you were going to shift your energy and resources, maybe shift is the wrong word, because I think anyone who's a parent, you have your energy and resources for your child, but you were going to shift the part of you that was reserved for your professional self and shift that into learning and therapy and understanding for your son, right? What was that moment like for you when you made the shift? Because I imagine this is before you kind of knew that Amazon was going to be a solid answer for you. And before you knew that it was going to work out and you could scale a business, this is just you making a determination about triaging the most important thing to you and who would have the best resources to provide it in that moment. So what was that time frame like where you knew you had to make a decision and you ultimately made the decision for yourself?
It was scary, but it was also a relief. So the scary part is there's so many unknowns. Like you said, I had a base of clients, regular clients that I'd worked with for years that I was saying goodbye for I didn't know how long, regular income from that. And also, could I even succeed at helping Austin, my son, the way that I needed to? Or was I just, you know, hoping that I would be able to help him in the way that he needed? But there is a huge relief when you decide to focus on one thing. And I know I was still working on Amazon nights and weekends and have another son as well. And we had lots going on. But all of the focus that before I had for all these other people were now just focused on this one project, on my kid. And that was a tremendous relief because before I was splintered so many different directions and still having the same doubts and fears about him and his future. We didn't know if he would ever live independently, if he could hold a job. There were so many fears already there that there's a relief when you say, okay, I don't know if I'm going to solve it, but if I focus everything I've got on it, at least I will know I am giving it everything I've got.
Because I think that oftentimes when we hear these stories around Amazon, there's a bunch of other brands that I won't name, but you hear about sellers in marketplaces where everyone's story sounds aspirational in such a way that I think it feels disconnected for a lot of people, right? So I think a lot of it, actually, we've talked about this on the podcast extensively because I have a passion for what I think the alternative is, but let's just kind of talk about the two, right? So we either hear the performative success, right? Like, look at my checks, my cars, my house, my, right? Like, Amy, tell me how much you made last week. And it's like, I have a check for $150,000, right? And it's consumable, it's quick, it's IG friendly, it's Snapchat friendly, right? Cool. That's one side. Then you kind of have the toxic positivity people, right? That's like all just mindset. Like, you know, if you don't succeed, it's because of you're in a mindset of scarcity. Like, if you don't succeed, it's because you didn't try enough, right? And I think that both of them, for most logical people, both seem a little silly, right? Like, I don't know if I'm going to get a car, and I don't know how many other people got the car from whatever you're doing. I'm not even sure if you even made that money from that thing. The other thing is that from the toxic positivity side, it all feels a little unhuman. It all feels a little just, it's so your best self that there's no space to grow, which almost says like, well, what's the distance between who I am and the problems I'm facing today and how I wake up in the morning and you who just seem to have it all together? What I think what's interesting about your story, though, is that though it seems aspirational in the way it's told, it's also because it was driven by a problem that you needed to solve, right? And I think that that's one of the most important stories that I don't find that comes out of marketplace stories, specifically Amazon stories, right? Is that a lot of the individuals that are successful because it was formed from a need, from a need that they had to fill, and the resources weren't there like they are now during the pandemic where everyone can work from home and everything's kind of feeling a little different. You had to find your own economy, right? You couldn't rely on a traditional economy to serve your needs. So you had to find a solution, and the Amazon economy became the solution. And so I just want to say thank you for sharing both halves of your story, because so often you only hear one, the succeeding half of it, which I think can disconnect a lot of folks. So I think it's really nice to hear you tell your story, and also to share that your story is also reflective of other people who have also joined this Amazon seller and found their way. I think there's really something super powerful about that.
Well, I appreciate that. And also, you know, you mentioned the, hey, look at my Ferrari, look at my giant house, here's my cool watch. You know, do you want to look at my therapy bill? Because that's what we, that's what we were paying off. But also, it was hard work. I mean, there was nothing pretty or easy or simple about any of this. It was choosing to work late at night. It was choosing to spend the weekend. My kid, who's now 14, my younger one, when he was 2 years old, he was stickering at Amazon inventory for a penny a sticker. Our kids were involved in this. We had them work. We taught them to work, that we pulled together as a family to solve problems. And so coming out the other end of it, I do have a very happy ending, but there's a lot of really hard work, slog, exhaustion in between, not gonna lie. But I'm very appreciative of the opportunity. So I would be remiss if I did not tell you that my kiddo, after 3 years of homeschooling slash really doing therapy, the last year of which we hiked almost the entire year, that was what we did. It helped him so much. Then he did 3 years in a special needs school, which Amazon helped us pay for because it cost a fortune. 3 years at a private prep academy. And now he's a junior at the University of Houston, making good grades, living on his own. So it was more than worth every single minute, because we did get the happy ending. But I really think that the marketplace, Amazon and eBay, helped us to accomplish that, because we could focus almost all of our energy just on the kid.
All right, so let's talk about loyalty, because that's how I opened the episode. I said, we're going to talk about loyalty, right? So as someone who consults in the space of marketplaces, how much emphasis do you put on sellers developing loyalty with people who are typically more inclined to transact with the marketplace than they are the actual seller themselves? Like, what's that conversation like first? And then I'll ask my follow-up question.
Sure. So it is so important to build first brand recognition so they even know who they should be loyal to. And then to build that loyalty, because you can get so lost on Amazon or eBay, or as a Shopify store, there's so much noise out there. So if you don't build some kind of relationship with your customer, you are missing out. But the thing is, my version of customer loyalty and how to get that isn't necessarily everyone else's version of customer loyalty and how to get that.
Which is why I said I'm going to hold for my second question. So I was going to say, so what's your strategy to build? Like, give me broad strokes. You don't have to get into like the nitty gritty of it, but what, how do you see that shaping?
So there are some real basics that, unfortunately, a lot of brands and a lot of sellers neglect when they sell online. And if you get the basics right, you've set up the building blocks for loyalty. So first of all is product quality. There are too many brands and too many sellers that do not focus on what the product looks like when it actually arrives at the buyer. Especially if you're using a fulfillment service, a 3PL, Amazon FBA, no matter what you're using, someone else is handling your product. Or even if you ship directly to that fulfillment house, it's getting touched. So how is it actually arriving to the buyer at the end? Great example, there are tons of supplement sellers all over the internet, tons of them on Amazon and on eBay. How often do you receive a supplement that you've ordered online, that it comes in the bottle with no box and it's got a broken seal or it's got part of the label scratched off? That does not engender confidence in the buyer. If they don't feel like they trust and love the product when they get it, that's a huge problem. And then the other thing I talk to sellers a lot about is creating some differentiation with what you're selling online versus what someone can go get in a retail store. So you can build loyalty just by having bundles of your branded items that they can't get somewhere else. I recently bought some cereal. It's called Magic Spoon. Have you seen Magic Spoon cereal? It's supposed to be like kids cereals, but for grownups.
So no, it's got I'm interested. Yeah.
It's got less sugar and more protein. So it's got like a one that's like a cocoa flavor and one that's a peanut butter flavor. Well, if you look on their Amazon store, they have these great bundles that are, there's one that's like one of each flavor. And then there's one that's like the peanut butter chocolate lovers. And if you go somewhere else to buy their products, you're not going to see those bundles. A lot of the CPG guys who sell food products, man, they do such a great job, because when you receive these bundles, they're nicely boxed in a box that's more like a carton, that's their own branded carton. No damage can be done to those products. They arrive to you perfectly, and you build loyalty because I can get that bundle on Amazon easily, one click, that I can't get somewhere else. It's a way to build loyalty just through your selection, your bundling, and then making sure that it actually arrives to me exactly how I want it or better than I wanted it.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. So I got a chance. My big start in e-commerce. I think this actually was my big start in e-commerce. My big start in e-commerce was working for a daily deal site called Daily Steals. And Daily Steals is a big player in the daily deal site. Just a lot of like refurbished phone parts. It was when like phones and like reselling your phones was like a big thing. Then they moved to Amazon, created their own independent goods. And I realized two of my big insights that I recognized in that space, because I was in charge of marketing, communication, PR, all of that stuff, and then eventually fell into operations. Is that one, if your item description, warranty description is not correct, then you can very easily turn someone from a very solvable problem into a headache, right? Just something as simple as like over communicating acceptance of packages. Because otherwise, the person then goes to Amazon, and Amazon now has a stronger advocate for their policy than what you had for yours. So where it looks like you were problematic for the customer, now Amazon is the solution, when in fact you could actually facilitate a solution on their behalf and earn that the right to work with that person again. So often, like, the difference between whether someone said we loved you or not was whether they actually took the time to say, hey, I'm going to write to you and this thing was broken. Can you fix it for me and send it? We're like, sure, we'll do that for you. If we leave it up to Amazon, the person goes, Amazon did it for me. Even though ultimately Amazon's going to utilize the supplier and or seller to do it, but Amazon gets the confidence, not the actual seller themselves. So oftentimes, sort of just even in your product, advocating for communication, for how to get in contact with us and doing all that stuff can be a huge way of just avoiding having Amazon to fix what you're talking about, right? The package came a little, you know, sort of broken, or, you know, it was in disrepair or whatever, right? And the seller gets the opportunity to fix it versus what I feel like is escalating it then to Amazon and having Amazon step in, knowing that their policy is probably going to be in your best interest.
Well, and I'll give you a great example. I have a client that was selling some very high-end candles, and these are like more expensive than Yankee candles, for example, but they're the same type candles, very large, and it's in a glass canister. The wax is poured directly in. And they were shipping these to Amazon and really expecting Amazon to package them in such a way they wouldn't get broken on the way to the customer. And so they had like a really flimsy box, wasn't working out. Amazon being Amazon, they put it in a padded envelope and shipped it to the customer. It makes me laugh every time I say it. A padded envelope for a glass candle. And as you can imagine, the breakage rate was massive. It was just absolutely huge. Well, you don't even get an opportunity to create a loyal relationship with a customer when what they receive is damaged? Because unless they already know you, so if they already know you and love you, they're going to reorder, ask for a replacement, whatever. If they don't already know you and love you, they're just going to want to return. And then they're going to buy someone else's candle that's in a metal container or that looks like it's going to come in better shape. All these folks had to do, because this was a high price point item for a home item, it was over $40, was to have a clamshell package, and all of their stock would have probably, most of it would have arrived in good shape, and they could establish that relationship with the customer and have them say, oh, I love this scent, I love the packaging, I love the item, I want to buy it again. But you have to give them that opportunity. And anytime something arrives a mess, that you've blown it, you know, they're not going to come back. I wouldn't come back. Would you?
I don't know. It's weird. I live in New York City, so I kind of expect everything to be thrown at my door. So 50% of the time, I think the mail person just chucked it and didn't really care. Unless it says fragile, like at 8 places on a package. In New York, they're just knocking them out the park. But I agree with you. I 100% agree with you that I think that like that level of attention to detail and ownership is super important because I think that's the point that I was getting to. I think you explained that in that story very well, Leslie, is that you also don't want someone to go back to the facilitator of an issue to solve the issue for you, because the facilitator who also created the issue becomes the one that saves the issue. So therefore that just engenders the person to that person more. Like it just makes them, endears the person more. I don't know, whatever. All right, I have a second question. How do you feel about seller responses to buyers, right? Because it's a tricky like balance between over responding and sounding like everything is an excuse, and never responding and letting your customer tell an individual story that doesn't allow another customer to make some level of determination, right? So we have the star system and we know how that works, but you know, everyone kind of just goes, I'm looking at the pictures, I'm looking at, you know, the buyer comments. So how do you feel about that? How do you feel about, you know, addressing buyer comments versus just letting them fly?
So if you get buyer comments on a regular basis, it's super important that you write templates when you're calm and happy. And this also goes for buyer-seller messaging on any platform where you receive complaints that the package didn't arrive, it was late, it was broken, it was damaged, it wasn't the right item. You've got to write templates for those in advance, because ideally you're going to have a VA or a staff member who answers these. Number one, you don't want them answered on the fly by anyone. And number two, you've got to take the emotion out of it and be positive and nice. And you would be amazed at some of the buyer-seller messages I've seen in sellers' accounts. It's appalling what they say to people. I've seen people who've actually been thrown off of platforms for the way they respond to buyers. But on reviews, it's the same thing. If you're going to respond on a review or on a question, it cannot be out of emotion. And you cannot make excuses ever for anything, because the next person who wants to buy that product, all they're going to see is the excuse. And when someone makes excuses, you do not trust them. When someone takes responsibility, you're much more likely to trust them. You don't have to say, hey, you're right, it was a piece of garbage. You don't have to do that, but you can say, oh my goodness, I'm so sad that you had this bad experience. We are definitely reaching out to you and we're going to make it right. That's not giving up anything. That's just saying I'm proactive and I respond quickly when someone's unhappy.
I mean, because the best thing that happens is someone gives a review, it's a bad review, they update the review, you respond, mm-hmm. They update the review and say, oh my God, this thing really worked out. The company did great by me. They sent me a replacement. It was awesome. So So what do you think about volume? Like, are you advising your clients to respond to all of them, positive and negative? Are you just focused on the big positives and maybe the really negative ones? Like, because I know that there are some spaces where even I, or people that I know, when I see like a seller respond to every comment, I'm like, aren't you supposed to be selling? Like, you really have time for every, and I don't know, for me, it just becomes like, it feels like overcompensation a little bit more than it does communication. Then when I see someone respond to nothing, I'm kind of like, oh, well, apparently you don't need the business because you don't care either way how someone's experiencing a product. So what do you think is a good balance in terms of communication when it comes down to reviews and comments?
I'm not big on responding to every positive comment because it actually disrupts the flow of reading the positive comments. It makes it harder for someone to scroll through them. There's too much noise. So if you've got a lot of nice positive comments, I would leave it be except. When someone has an exceptional use for a product, when they tell a heartwarming story, anything like that, you want to respond because then someone will pause and read that positive comment. So the ones, you know, oh, my little boy was having trouble walking and then we bought this toy and now he'll do anything to follow the toy. And here's the video of his first steps with the toy. Oh my goodness. Comment on that and say, this is so wonderful. Thank you for sharing with us. This brightens our day. And then people will pause there. But on the negative ones, you do need to respond if you can. And again, not take responsibility like we done it, but take responsibility like we're going to make this better for you. We care about our customers.
Okay. So you say, Leslie, no. So template writing, right? So I've seen template writing where you think to yourself, who wrote that? Like, just who wrote that, right? Because templates, the best templates, very much like the best cold call scripts, should never sound like a template, right? They should have the ability to be repeated and feel slightly varied, but in essence have the same core components, right? So that you're not having to type everything new every time. If I'm listening right now and I'm like, man, I really do need to put some templates together, right? Like, what's my process? Do I hire a copywriter? Am I getting an intern? Am I doing it myself and throwing it in Grammarly? Like, what's a really good way to really produce some templates that at least in Dion's opinion should have clarity? Should have some level of voice and a tone that feels like it isn't attacking or felt attacked. I feel like those are the three best things for a templated response, right? Like, there's clarity, that your tone is right, and that you neither seem like you're attacking someone or that you feel attacked. If you can get those done, then you're probably in good shape. But I could also be wrong because I also am like, thank you so much with like three O's, and I probably do too much in my responses too. So what's your advice on how to get a good set of templated response organized?
Well, and I think you're dead on that the goal is to not be defensive or attack, but to solve the problem. The goal is always to solve the problem, the end. So if you are a very small brand and you're the brand owner and that's what you got, and then you've got a VA, it's on the brand owner to write it. But then I would ask several friends who are in business, who are savvy consumers, different demographics of people, a man, a woman, different ages, to read those and see if anything sets their spidey senses off. Like, this sounds kind of mean, or did you know your word choice here could come across bad? Because we all use words sometimes that other people don't like, and we didn't even think about it, of how that could be, you know, off-putting. If you're in a small business, your marketing person should definitely be involved in helping with these templates, because you're right, the tone's important. Also, you want to include your branding at the bottom. You need to have, you know, if it's a marketplace where you can add it, you want to have a logo, you want to have contact information, you want to have your little statement, your value statement, or your tagline, whatever it is. Branding is important everywhere. But having that tone be like the tone of your company, the voice of your company, is really important. And like you said, it's nice to have, I've done a lot of template writing in the past, and I'll have brackets and say, insert whatever here. So I'll say, insert greeting here, because that way you might say good day or hello or hi, thanks for writing. And it's different each time so that it's not like the exact same response, because that starts to feel like a robot and nobody wants that.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So we're talking about customer loyalty, and I think we've described it as something that I think is really, really fair, which is, in order to get to the point of loyalty, you have to build trust, right? So trust comes first, and trust is your product being described as delivered, your product being delivered, in the time frame approximate to when it was supposed to, and it arrives in a condition that allows it to be usable and functional for the person it was intended.
Yes, absolutely. Product quality is key.
Yes. All right. And your lighting just really hit. Like, I don't know what your sun. I don't know.
That's the sun moved.
Yeah, no, that's always pretty awesome. So talk to me about. About metrics, right? Like I mentioned sort of owning your customer, but can you really do that in a marketplace? In essence, it's really their customer and you're just a provider, right? So do you get metrics to know like how many customers have fell off? And is there a way for you to track that and figure out like how to get those people back in line with your brand? Or are you really just kind of beholden to the marketplace that you're in? And if that person hasn't communicated with you outside of that platform, if they're allowed to, then you're really just hoping that they come back to you or hoping that you're in their feed for a recommended item the next time.
So there are reports that you can run on Amazon. You can easily see on eBay and some other marketplaces where you can see repeat buyers. How good is that data? It's not great data. One thing that you should really shoot for on Amazon specifically is subscribe and save. If you can set up subscribe and save, that is a magical customer magnet. That's where someone can choose. They can say, I want this delivered every 6 weeks. I want a quantity of 2 every 3 weeks, whatever it is. Once you've established that kind of loyalty, it's mailbox money. It's fantastic revenue for sellers. And you would be amazed at what people will subscribe and save to. I used to think of it as only food and like supplements and maybe some makeup or like face care kind of things. People will subscribe and save to socks. People will subscribe and save to all kinds of items that you would not imagine. And if you go on Amazon and look around, you'll be like, oh my goodness, that doesn't even make sense.
I want to validate this for folks. I have on my subscribe and save, toilet tissue, toilet paper, dishwashing, detergent, laundry, stuff. But I also have V-neck white t-shirts because I go on a lot of like meetings and I always run out of t-shirts or they end up just getting too dark. I have dress socks because I know I'm going to lose them in the laundry. So I keep them on repeat. I also have, it's going to sound so silly, but I also have book bags. So I go to the gym. I live in New York. I place them on floors, whatever. So I end up putting them in the washing machine. My book bags only have about 2 months of wear and tear before I can't use them again. And by the time I realize I can't use it again, I need it, right? So like, one day, just one shows up at my door. I put it in about a week and a half after it shows up. I'm like, God, I'm so glad I could throw this one away. And I pick up the next one. And so I 100% agree with you. There are things that literally I should be going out and purchasing, but the price is great. The fact that I don't have to think about it is amazing. And the fact that it's kind of on a timer that aligns with, something else that I have, candles. Because usually at about the 3 month mark, my candles go out and I have to go get candles. And I hate like Marshalls and I hate big lines and all that. So those are all my thing too. So I 100% agree with you, right? It's not just about perishable items. It's not about like just kind of those consumer goods for the bathroom and kitchen. Like that subscribe and save, just it works all throughout your house. And so, yeah, if you're a seller right now, she's 100% on, because I definitely, probably half of my purchases per month are just automatically deducted and sent to me specifically from Amazon. Don't know about a lot of other marketplaces, but specifically from Amazon.
And that is the ultimate in loyalty right there. Someone who just has an automatic order set up. I have an athlete in my house who, despite being 14 years old, has giant feet. And so I have these socks that come every 6 months and you can make it 6 months to replace his socks that he wears out, because we have to get the size 13 to 15 socks for him. And I have them on order, because if I wait until he's out, it's too late. It takes a while to get them. So I know I'm not the only one. And once I love a brand, I'll put it on order. It's such a great opportunity. And that is where things like Prime Day and this new October Prime Day and where Black Friday and Cyber Monday come in too. People think that the consumer is just buying like electronics and cool appliances and gift items during those times. That is not true. You can move anything on a marketplace during those time periods. Everything you sell goes up in volume. And so these are great opportunities to do special deals, like Deal of the Day and Prime Day deals. All of these, you advertise leading up to them. You get someone to try your product, and then you cross your fingers and you hope that you can get them on Subscribe and Save, because that right there is a way to create, like I said before, it's like mailbox money, these regular customers who love you and who now have added you to their rotation of goods that they're receiving on a regular basis. So all of these sales periods in these special times are an opportunity to say, what is our strategy to have more people on Subscribe and Save?
So at what point in my year should I really be thinking about it? Or I guess maybe backtrack from the day of. So let's say I'm thinking Black Friday, I'm thinking Cyber Monday. When am I really starting to plot my marketing? When am I starting to plot my strategy? Am I thinking about it in July? Am I thinking about it at the top of the year when I'm planning out my year? Am I thinking about it in September and working through to get the marketing out in October for November? Like what from let's say a median of your experiences and your successful client experiences in driving sales and having the correct marketing for a particular date or a particular event that's happening in a marketplace like Amazon, what's a good amount of time in order to make sure that you're prepared, let's say for your first one? Maybe the learning curve is shorter the more years you do it. But let's say your first one, how much time should I be allotting for me to kind of figure out my products, get my marketing right, and then be prepared for that day?
So let's use fourth quarter as an example. So we're looking at peak. And so peak is really from like Black Friday until about a week before Christmas. That's peak sales. So you back it up first to, when do I have to land my inventory? So most people are trying to land their inventory and get it into a warehouse, whether with their 3PL or whoever's fulfilling Amazon or whoever. They're trying to get it there by September. It's for safety reasons, especially now in the past couple of years with all the logistics issues. You don't want to land it just in time. That's too dangerous. So if you're landing your inventory in September, when are you ordering it? Well, depending on your source, a lot of times that's backed up to about February, right? So February, March, you're ordering for that September order. So you better have in mind then what your potential loss leaders or best deals of the day are going to be. If you're going to try, if you have a family of products in your brand, what is the one you can put out there, give a great deal for a Cyber Monday and have a huge discount, do some great PPC advertising you can invest in up to that, and then get people to look at your entire family of products based on the success of that, you know, deal of the day or Prime Day deal or Cyber Monday deal. You'd be amazed at how much volume you can do off of one great deal on one ASIN. It's incredible. But then you pick up your PPC ads and your display ads to the audience that you've learned about from that deal and advertise your entire family of products in your brand to create a funnel. So how much time do you need? Well, if you're ordering the products in February, March, you should be outlining that strategy by early summer, because you're going to have to budget the funds you need to funnel people into your entire line off of that one great deal.
So, we're going to talk about a few things. The first thing, though, is kind of overall strategy. So what you're saying is that you want to prepare for the event, but you also want to leverage that event to then sell the products, the other products that you weren't focused on maybe specifically for that event. And you want to serve those to the same person who was interested, the same buyer that was interested in that event days or that Amazon, whatever the day is. You want to then leverage what you learned about that customer then, and then serve them up some other products. So you're not really just focused on the day and marketing for the day, but you're marketing for the day so that you could then remarket other items to that customer.
Absolutely. So smart money, if you have a great deal, you can't just put up the deal. You do PPC ads for a week ahead of time, maybe 2 weeks, maybe a few days, depends on your category and the kind of competition in that category. Yep. But then you would be amazed at the long tail sales that you will get after the price goes back up. So say you did a 20% discount for 2 days, then the price goes back up. It's at 100%. You will continue to reap the rewards of the PPC budget plus that deal that you made for the 20%, 30% off, with long tail sales, better bestseller rank, better SEO inside of the algorithm of whatever marketplace that you're on. You're going to reap that for some time and see elevated sales from that one deal.
Now, you mentioned loss leader, right? Mm-hmm. And loss leader is, I think, still contested in the e-commerce space, right? Whether so I'm going to do my best to define it, and then maybe you can do your best to define it, and then we can talk about it, right? So for me, loss leadership is when you look at the competitive landscape of pricing for a very similar, if not the same product, and you make a determination to have the lowest price in the market possible. And by doing so, one of two things happens. Either your volume goes up because your price is lower than everyone, or it creates a loss leadership game where you then start to see the other sellers in the same market try to drop their price to compete with your price, and everyone is dropping their price until the sellers have to remove themselves from the game because the product is no longer profitable, if not breaking even. There's a moment where they're just losing money on the product, and therefore they can no longer participate in this game, specifically if they don't have this longer tail strategy that you just described earlier, right? So there are some people that say loss leadership is what gets people interested in your product. It's a great way to build awareness of your brand, of your product, because people are like, wow, it's priced well. Then if the reviews match and it seems like the stars are there, then people are completely with you, and you probably just gained yourself a whole bunch of customers. The other side of it is that it deflates the price of everyone else in order to try to compete, and therefore it's harmful to the broader market. What do you feel about it?
So generally speaking, over the last 10 years of e-commerce, I'm not a fan of race to the bottom. And I think that sellers do a lot to hurt themselves when they think they're hurting the other guy by exactly what you're talking about. However, in our current market state, I think we're going to see more and more of this. And I think that some brands are going to have no alternative but to have a loss leader or a very low priced item to try and draw people in. And I'll tell you why. I've got a lot of clients right now who are still holding last year's Q4 inventory. And the reason is because it did not land until January or February. Yeah. Because of all of the supply chain issues. So then they were put in this position, what do I order for this Q4? And by the nature of online sellers, if you know any online sellers, you know they didn't say, oh, I'm going to order nothing. I'm just going to sell last year's. Of course they ordered more because that's what you do online. Yep. And you hope you're going to find a way to drive it all out the door. But they still have a lot of fears and concerns because they still have a bunch of that inventory. Some of it's seasonal. Some of it's winter goods, some of it's like seasonal, like being holiday themed. And there's a bunch of it in the marketplace right now. So I think because of that pressure, you are going to see more people willing to drive down their pricing at the end of 2022 than you're going to see maybe in the last 10 years.
Got it. Okay. And that's interesting, right? Because the broader story is that specifically because of the pandemic and still sort of these lingering fears around shopping and the shopping experience, that Amazon came out as a clear winner, mm-hmm. right? Because people just did record amounts of shopping on Amazon, right? And then on the seller side, right, there's a question of volume and profitability per item, right? So you could have shipped a lot out the door, but you could be losing in profit margins on each of the things that are shipped. So did sellers have the type of record pandemic years that the story of Amazon had? So did a lot of your clients just see these booms, or was it dependent on what specific things you were selling? Because some things, you know, specifically in sort of safety and cleaning and all that just shot up in record numbers. Were other items like maybe, I don't actually know. I'm such like across the spectrum buyer. I don't even know what I would say. Like people weren't buying.
I'm gonna say
maybe like protein supplements, because maybe they weren't going to the gym as much because access to the gym. So if you were in that like whey protein type space, might have not really done that well because people were just kind of like, no, I'll pass. Like, there's no gym for me. I don't know. I'm looking around, like trying to figure out something that I would have passed on. But the broader question and the central question is, were sellers able to do as well during this pandemic period than what the story of Amazon's overall success in the pandemic was? So is that what you're seeing?
So on average, sellers did extremely well. And I think that on average, it tracked with how Amazon did overall. There were some specific categories that did much better than others and some that were terrible. So if you were selling luggage, you were in trouble because no one was buying any luggage. If you were selling home exercise equipment, you were the bomb, right? People were cooking at home. So at the beginning, there was this flood of demand for, you know, like garlic presses and toasters. You couldn't find a toaster, but no one was buying makeup. And clothing sales for better clothing did not exist. Now, if you were selling sweats and yoga pants, you were doing pretty awesome because we were all comfy sitting at home working, right? So, there were definitely winners and losers, but on the average, everyone definitely saw the tide rise. And after there was some normalization of those categories and people started semi going back to work and going back to work in some places in the US. Yep. I think everyone saw an increase because people still didn't want to go out and shop, right? So then all the categories were lifting a little bit. And now I don't think we're seeing it go down. We're seeing like a leveling off combined with pressures from inflation, decreased consumer demand for non-essential items, just because of fear about the economy. And that, so again, you're seeing winners and losers, right? So the winners are essentials. People still want to buy their essentials on Amazon. They still don't want to shop. If they're like me, I hate to shop. And so Amazon comes by here several times a week. But some of the more luxury items, when you're feeling unsure, you're not going to buy the more expensive makeup. You're not going to buy the more expensive dresses.
Got it. So what, how do you think Amazon does with cannibalization, considering that they have their own brands, right? So they have their own brands, their own Amazon brands. Like, do you as a seller ever feel like you're competing with their brands? I think Sonos, I believe Sonos might be one of their brands. I think they do like shampoo, soaps, like bathroom type stuff. I was fortunate to work with someone who came out of product development at Amazon for a bit. And so we talked a bit about this, about all of the products that they were coming out with. And more specifically, that the products would have their own name, their own branding. So it wouldn't be obvious to the consumer that this is, in fact, an Amazon brand and not a seller that's separate and different from Amazon. So how do you feel about that? Like, not in any way to be, you know, contested. We're still very small podcast, so this probably won't break anything, right? But how do you feel about this sort of idea that within this marketplace, where there are sellers that are supposed to be providing products, that the marketplace itself is also providing products and naming those products so that those products are equally branded to the sellers?
So I don't love it, and I don't love it for a different reason than a lot of folks. Sure. There's the competition aspect, which is daunting. But then again, you know, if you go to any brick and mortar retailer, they have their own private label brand of clothing. And oftentimes it is not branded Walmart brand or Kohl's brand. It's got some brand where if you don't know the store, you have no idea that's their private label store brand items. And so it's, to me, it's not unusual or strange that an online marketplace should do the same. However, Amazon has proven itself to be unreliable and untrustworthy in this area. So they have used data from third-party sellers who've developed their own private label brands, and they've used it in such a way that they have developed their own brands, piggybacking on their research and sometimes even the suppliers involved. And I'm not saying anything that isn't public knowledge. After some news stories that have come out, it's all very concerning. However, on the positive side, you know, Congress and some of the state's attorneys generals have been making a lot of noise about this. And probably in part because of that, Amazon recently announced that they were discontinuing several of those private label brands. Now, I have talked to folks who have told me that actually they're discontinuing the lines that are not profitable. They have several lines that they overinvested and they overshot on inventory. And really, they make a lot of money off sellers, yeah, off third-party sellers. So their margins on their own products have to be pretty dang impressive to make sense for them to take all the risk and the sourcing and the logistics and all the things. When, you know, for their third party sellers, they're making what, 30 to 40% off each item, plus storage fees, plus all the PPC advertising, all those things. So your margins have got to be incredible to want to compete with sellers. And it's just a bad look. I would bet that they're going to continue discontinuing some of these products because they just don't want the regulatory scrutiny.
I mean, listen, I feel like I agree with you 100%. I do think that, to me, the use of supplier data or transaction data in order to position folks in the market, specifically when you're going to private label in that market, is to me the same conversation as competition. I think that there's fair competition and then unfair competition, but in a way, we now all know that the real economy is in the data itself, right? The products, the sellers, all that becomes important to the logistics of it, but it's in essence the data that is the true economy that's running these businesses, because without it, it wouldn't have algorithms that would recommend products. It wouldn't be able to decide whether someone should get an automatic 10% off. There's just a whole bunch of stuff that's run by the data, right? And so in a way, it's like, I don't know if you guys have, like Street Easy. Where are you located?
Texas.
Texas. All right. So in New York, like even in real estate, right? Like one of the competitors in real estate was also wanted to sell and transact real estate when really they were just a marketplace. You go in there, look for places to rent, look for places to sell. And they had to make a choice in essence, because it couldn't be both, because you are receiving data. And so you're making decisions off of data. And so now we have to figure out whether you parse that specific data from a supply, from a landlord, and separated that from a data, from the data that you got yourself, right? And it all becomes tricky, right? And so I think it's interesting, right? A little different than walking in a store also is that the user determines their path in a store. You can have point of sale stuff anywhere and lead people. And we know that places like Walmart and Target have become specialists in leading people. But ultimately, it's the person that decides this. In online marketplaces, it's facilitated for you, right? Because in these platforms, you are being shown what you already purchased, what you might like, right? So there's a level of discovery that's curated by the marketplace that in a store, you would just discover what you wanted as you wanted to discover it. So there's almost even an unfairness to that in a way that they get to curate for you, where in a regular storefront, you sort of get to walk, you know, in everywhere except for behind the register in the storeroom, right? Like you get a storage room, right? You get to just sort of freely follow your own path. And so I think that's interesting too, right? Is that they also not only get the data and to create the product, but they also get to curate your experience, which when it's all about your benefit is great, but there's also a space where it could also be advantageous to the marketplace to do it in order to position the goods that they want to in front of the customer instead of all things being equal. Is that fair?
Right, and yes, and there's been a lot of controversy about Amazon serving up their own private label products in search results at the top, even though when you look at the data for those products, it doesn't justify it. They have far fewer ratings. Yeah. They appear to have less volume. They haven't been on the platform as long. Yeah. All these reasons that it makes no sense for them to be at the top. And you make a great example of the grocery store. Think about, like, you get the grocery store circular, right? Yep. And so let's say it's Kroger and they've decided to have one of those weeks where they push their own brands, which happens. They'll do like 10 for 10 on our canned vegetables or whatever. But when you walk down the aisle to look at those, the Del Monte has still got the placement that's at eye level. Yep. I mean, they're not moving everything around the shelves and pretending that the whatever the brand is, that's the nice brand, isn't a better seller in general than their Kroger branded items. It's not nearly as manipulative, really. And if you go on their online, or if you go like on Walmart online and buy groceries, they don't prioritize their private label branded products quite as much as Amazon does with no justification. It's really kind of shocking. So I do think that this makes it ripe for regulation and ripe for a lot of government interference, which is why they backed off some, and I hope they back off more. It is estimated about 1% of the goods sold on Amazon.com are Amazon's private label products. Is it worth blowing up the marketplace over that 1%? And many of those items aren't profitable. I don't think so.
Yeah. And listen, I mean, the beautiful story around just the idea of a marketplace, right, is this idea of this kind of equitable access, right? That if you have a device that can connect to the internet and you're able to, you have a card that you can put on it, right? Then it's equitable. It's not equal in the way that not everyone across every place in the world has access to stable Wi-Fi and all that, right? So let's take all that aside. Let's say it's all just about you're equitable, you have the access to it, and you can make the purchase if you have the funds, right? So the idea is that all things really should be shown, right? Because that's why they're sellers, and that's why there are diverse sellers, and that's why there are niche products, and that's why there are broad products, because whatever you're looking for in the marketplace, you should be able to find and then scroll through and figure out what you want to do. All right, so I have a question. I am new to marketplaces, right? But I really, really want to get selling on something. I don't know what. I don't have a passion. I'm not passionate yet, right? I am Leslie. I'm a mom. I'm trying to figure out what I can do. I don't know what my starting product is. Am I reselling on eBay? Am I putting together potpourri on and selling it to Amazon? Like, what are like three kind of cool starter items for someone who's considering getting into marketplace selling right now?
Okay, so first I'm going to tell you the forbidden strategy that everyone will tell you not to do, but it still works.
All right, let's go.
It minimizes the risks associated with this bigger strategy. So for years, people did retail arbitrage to get started selling on Amazon. All that means, and on eBay and everywhere else, all that means is you go to a retail store, you find a product that's selling significantly cheaper there than it's selling online, you sell it online.
Got it.
Okay, that can be really dangerous because the brands can make intellectual property complaints, people complain it's inauthentic, there's all this garbage that can happen, but if you have a true outlet mall near where you live, and by true outlet mall, I mean not a collection of stores that it's just the brands selling at their regular prices, but the ones where they're actually really selling discontinued items at a discount, you are buying direct from the manufacturer. So even though you're buying it at a retail store, you're buying direct from the manufacturer, and that means you're going to have great receipts and invoices that will fight off any inauthentic or intellectual property complaint. That is a great way to get started. I have actually sold that way off and on for many years to make some fast cash. It's awesome. So that's number one. A lot of people get started that way to put money in the bank to do the next strategy, which is my very favorite. Wherever you live, there are business parks. Especially if you live in suburbia, there are business parks. Go visit the business parks in your town. You are going to find someone in those business parks who is selling products to wholesalers or distributors, or maybe to some retail stores, but they don't have an online presence. You can make a deal with those guys and say, I want to be your exclusive online seller. I'm going to put you on Amazon, put you on eBay, set up your Shopify, whatever your specialty is. Usually you can make a deal with these folks where they will take returns on the items you don't sell. You can try and build their brand online. It's super cool. There are so many great mom and pop businesses out there that just need someone to help them get online. They have no interest in doing it. And if the great thing about that is you're the only one selling the product, you're not competing against other sellers. Like if you went to a wholesaler or a distributor, which makes it really hard, right? Because then it's the race to the bottom.
Yeah.
And then when you've made money off of that, the third strategy is you need a private, everyone needs a private label product. And that is a niche product. It needs to be something that there's, it solves a problem in your life. So like if Amazon stops selling Amazon Basics, then I'm not going to know where to find my size 13 to 15 socks for my giant boy's feet, right? So that's a perfect example of if that goes away, there's going to be a need in the marketplace. I found out it's really hard to get girdles for football in sizes bigger than 2X unless you go direct to the manufacturer. There are all kinds of needs like this that you have with your own family or your own personal needs where there is a niche. And the beautiful thing about Amazon and other online marketplaces, they are the best small business incubators in the history of the world. You can literally create, source from a contract manufacturer, land a product, launch it, and see if there's enough demand nationwide for $5,000.
So everyone, mostly, some people are like, no, I don't want that, but everyone mostly imagines that everyone wants what they're going to produce, right? Like, I'm going to sell this on Amazon and everyone's going to want it. From business is run in percentages, right? Like, mostly, right? So what's a healthy business in Amazon look like? Like, what, if I'm looking at profitability, right? And what's my margin? Is it 10%, 20%, 5%? Like, how do I know that I'm running a profitable business in Amazon outside of it breaking through the threshold of breaking even? Like, what's a good range where I can look at my business and go, you know what? Maybe I'm onto something versus being like, I don't really know about it, right? I might be selling a lot of it, but it may not work for me. Or, hey, I may only have a very select few sellers, but they're willing to pay my price point, and I may need to just invest to find more people like them. Like, what's that a margin of profitability that maybe would let you know that your business is looking like it might be in a healthy space?
So healthy and exciting in a marketplace like Amazon is if you launch a private label product and you can sell 10 to 20 units a day and your margins are anywhere from 15 to 30%, because you're looking to create something where you have those repeated sales over time and then you launch a second product and a third product. You don't have to sell 100 units a day to have a really nice income stream and some nice margin. You just need that regular sales where you're ordering every 3 to 4 months. You don't want to have so little that you sell that you're ordering all the stock one time and carrying that cost, right? But if you can get yourself to 10 to 15 sales, build up to 20 sales a day, I know it doesn't sound like much, but it can get pretty exciting over time. And I have a lot of clients who've done just that, where they have no super great, amazing product. They have 5, 6, or 7 stellar products that are selling, you know, 10 units here, 20 units here per day. And they're making $3 on this one, $5 on that one. You add it up. You know, you've paid all your bills.
Okay. For a month. All right. 2 more questions. And then I'm going to ask you the questions that I ask everyone that's a guest on Men versus Brand. All right. So here are my 2 questions. The first is for my seasonal sellers, right? Like, maybe I focus on Easter stuff, or maybe I focus on Hanukkah stuff, or maybe I focus on any of the holidays that might be specific to a community or multiple communities or my community, right? What's my strategy for the rest of the year? Like, am I really just focusing on that time frame? Should I look to also be in play in the market all throughout the year, because people may be searching for it in preparation? Like, how do I deal when I'm a pure seasonal person? I'm thinking about the holidays, but it also may apply to, you know, winter stuff when we're not in the winter season, or very specific summer stuff. What should I actually? No, I'm going to take that away. I'm going to remove both of those, because I think clothing people travel throughout the year. They may buy clothing, seasonal stuff at other times. Let's really talk about holiday stuff, because I think holiday is probably as seasonal as it gets. So if I'm selling seasonal stuff, you know, I'm in that market. I'm selling Santas. I'm selling ornaments. I'm selling dreidels. I'm selling whatever I'm selling. Like, how should I look at the year if I want to do well at Amazon? Am I focused on a specific time period, or am I looking at a wider year strategy?
So first of all, you want to always be in stock. I know that sounds crazy, but for example, used car lots do Christmas in July sales, and they buy those stupid inflatable things that people put on their lawns, like the big snowmen. Yeah. They will buy those in July. And so if you're in stock, you can have a really high price and they will buy it. You want to always be in stock on all of your items, because just a few sales outside of your season will keep your bestseller rank from tanking, and it will help you to be ahead of the other guys who didn't bother to stay in stock. So that's one thing. Another is, it really depends on what you want to be when you grow up, right? So I know some people who really sell seasonally because they only want to work for that season.
Yeah.
That is their deal. I know someone who does bundles for Christmas, and that is all they do.
Yeah.
And they love it because they prep their stuff in the summer. They ship it all to the warehouse and they're out. Right. Yeah. So that's awesome if that's what you want to do and you want to have that extra income stream. But for most sellers, having some evergreen products is going to help you to fund more inventory for your successful holiday items. Because you got to remember, you've got to buy that stock. You can't spend the money that you need to buy that next year's stock, right? You've got to set that aside. So if you want to grow, a lot of times it does take having some kind of an evergreen product so that you can continue to grow your holiday business.
All right. Thank you for that. Thank you for that insight. All right. Last question, and then we get to the two. So I'm about to sell, right? I'm looking at the ecosystem of marketplaces, right? And I may mispronounce some of you guys, but forgive me. There's Mercari, Poshmark, Amazon, AliExpress, maybe Alibaba. There's like, which ones am I missing? I said Poshmark, Mercari. There's a bunch of them, right? Point being, yep. I'm not going to dribble on, guys, with my inability to remember all of the ones. I probably should have asked Leslie. She probably has a bit more of this on as top of the brain stuff. But you have all of these marketplaces, right? Like, and some of them are sort of like they tend to feel slightly more like they're thrift-ish. Some of them seem more like luxury resale. Some of them seem like just consumer goods and everything else, right? How am I really determining like where I'm selling? Because there's a lot of crossover in a lot of these marketplaces, right? So how do I know, like, I have a candle. My candle seems like it's kind of luxury. Am I looking to do one marketplace to start, test it? Am I testing it in multiple marketplaces? Maybe lower inventory to see which one does a little better. Like, how am I starting out if I have a product that I'm confident will sell? I just don't know which marketplace I'm looking to sell. Like, how do I start to determine maybe and zero in on maybe some of the marketplaces that this thing might perform in?
So the first thing is exactly what you said. You have to figure out kind of the category of what you're looking at. If this is a general consumer brand, you want to be where the general consumer shopping is. If this is something that feels more custom or handmade, you might think more about an Etsy or a Poshmark, somewhere along those lines, right? And then eBay feels a little more thrifty. Use that word. I agree. A lot of times eBay people see that as a thrifty marketplace, even though there are brands on there that do sell direct. So you have to have kind of the feel, what kind of feeling and brand temperament are you looking for out there? And then you have to start looking at competitors, because you might find out that one of these marketplaces has a big hole in it It does happen, even for items you wouldn't think that it happens, that there's a lot of opportunity. You can look at other similar items. It'll tell you how many have sold in the last month sometimes. I know on Etsy, it'll say 25 of this is sold in the last 30 days. So you can see exactly what kind of demand there is. Because if there's not enough demand, you need to bump yourself up to a more generalized marketplace. As far as ease, you want to figure out where it's easy for you to fulfill the order and easy for you to create a good listing. So for that reason, I usually do recommend people try one marketplace at a time. You got to figure out the first one before you jump into the second one. They're all different. And if you try and do them all at once, you can really kind of create a mess. You can also fail to fulfill because you kind of forget about one because you've got two or three others. And that's a big nightmare because that'll get you banned.
Okay. All right. Well, I have two questions for you. I ask these two questions of everyone that's on Man vs. Brand. Just a way for us to learn more about you and what you enjoy. So on any streaming platform, regular TVs included, what's something that you've recently watched that you thoroughly enjoyed?
Oh my goodness. So this is so nerdy, Dion.
No, you would be surprised, okay, at how nerdy and how specific people are about what they watch. And that's the point. That's the whole point of this is to learn not just about you and what you're doing over at Riverbend and about Amazon, but also about like what, right? It's the man part of the brand, right? Like what gets you excited? Like what do you really love? So talk to me. Let's get nerdy. Let's go.
So recently I was under the weather and I was trying to distract myself. You know how when you're not feeling well, you can start to think about all the bad things going on, right? Or even imagined bad things. So I got myself over on Amazon Prime and I searched for Cary Grant. I love Cary Grant. So Cary Grant was a movie star back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, y'all. And I went down this bunny trail and watched all of these movies that I'd never seen before, which is amazing because I'm a big like classic movies watcher. All these movies I'd never seen from the 30s and 40s. It was amazing. All these old stars. And what I found out, y'all, there are some racy movies out there from the 30s and 40s. Like, racy. I was shocked at some of them about, like, illegitimacy and affairs and all these things that you do not picture being in movies from, like, the 30s. Oh my. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was like stepping into a different time. I watched like four movies over 2 days, which is something I would never do. Yeah. And now I know that Amazon Prime has like a billion movies I've never seen.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Because I remember a time period where Netflix had movies that kind of came out in like the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, and that was it. Hulu had obscure TV shows and not too much movie stuff. And Amazon had like, this is what my brain remembers, a lot of like really cool period piece type stuff, like back in the day, before everyone was making original content, before relicensing started happening, you know, before streaming became a thing. And to your excitement, or to what you're excited about, me and my aunt share a mutual love of period work. Like we love period work, right? Like anything period, we're on it. We have now moved into Chinese dynasty period pieces because we've watched most of the American and most of the European over the course of our time. So we're in that space right now. But yeah, no, I love that stuff. I love specifically like the costuming, the colloquialism, like the speech pattern, like how different speech has evolved over time. And I think, as a person of color, I've learned to appreciate the things that I didn't see and the things that I did, right? Because I'd be like, well, nobody looks like me except for that one lady, you know, standing on the thing, but it would be Lena Horne, and she would have this beautiful song, and you have to appreciate Lena Horne for having that moment, and then the rest of the movie becomes the rest of the movie, right? And so even now, just kind of seeing those old school, and I don't know what era Lena Horne was in, I'm just referencing her because she, in my mind, she's in that Cary Grant sort of era, but just there's those moments where you see that person and you're like, that was fantastic. And then as an adult, to realize what it took to be Lena Horne then, you're like, wow, that woman was strong. So I could talk to you about period stuff all day. I love it. So you're with a fellow nerd in that space. We're good. We're good on that. All right. So let's talk about this. Let's talk about something that if maybe I ask like your family or friends, they may not know that you are into, but you secretly enjoy it on any streaming platform or TV. What's something that you're like, I love this, but maybe it's just for you to love. Not necessarily a guilty pleasure, but you just, it's your thing. A lot of people may not know it's your thing, but it is definitively yours.
Okay, so this does fall under guilty pleasure, though.
What?
I've loved true crime podcasts. I love them. And I'm someone, I don't watch a lot of TV. I'll stream something, but I don't watch TV. However, yeah. I will listen to the Dateline podcast about all the killed and missing people. What is wrong with me? And you know what's funny? I've talked to other people about this and asked the question, and apparently demographically, women in their 30s and 40s are who listen to true crime. I'm fascinated by this. I fall into that demographic. I want to know why, but I have no idea.
You know, it's funny. So I had this conversation with someone. I believe it was on this podcast. Might have not been, because I have a lot of conversations with a lot of people about a lot of wide range of topics, right? But someone recently said to me, and I thoroughly now agree with them, and I've been like pushing this theory a lot in my own conversations around media, specifically around television, movies, and entering podcasts into that space, is that there's a lot of predictability in storytelling right now. We're in an era where like everything's being rehashed. Like really, reality TV, like the 90 Day Fiance, who's going to marry who, who's going to punch who, and podcasting, specifically true crime, is really the only spaces where you find you're not quite sure how this thing is going to turn out, unless you are a diehard fan. So if you're a diehard fan of 90 Day, if you're, that's all you watch and like that's all you consume, you probably get it. If you followed this specific case all the way through, then you probably know, right? But for the average person that's just a casual watcher of things, almost every other type of genre, you can probably figure out what the end's going to look like, except true crime and like trashy reality TV. So when people tell me either, I never feel a way about it because I understand why. Like, it's like, I don't want to watch another Friends. I don't want to watch another this. I don't want to watch another that. I want to engulf myself in something where there are twists and turns and reveals and questions, and I'm in conflict about how I feel about the direction or the insight, right? And I'm going through this emotional and logical journey that seems maybe outside of my own existence, like my own life path, but it's interesting nonetheless. And that's how I feel about the, you know, Love Islands and about the true crimes, right? Like they don't fit cleanly into anything that's in my life, but there's also not this very obvious end to any of it. Therefore, I think a lot of people are really, really engaged in the material because it's not scripted in a way that the result ends up being as obvious and the journey boring. And so when you have that, I think you got a lot of interest across the board. So I can see why you would be into true crime. I think that it's great. And every time I listen to a really good one, I'm left with questions, concerns, appreciation, outrage. Like, I'm left feeling emotions that the average movie doesn't give me anymore. I just go to it and I'm like, that was nice. Like, that was cool. Like, you know, had that experience, right? Like, I'm not the only person on the internet that didn't experience it now, right? Where in those things, you are literally going through an emotional spectrum. So I 100% could see why that could be a guilty pleasure or just a general pleasure.
You're so right. You're so perceptive and absolutely dead on, because I love listening to them when I'm like doing mindless tasks. Like if I have to fold some laundry or I'm making dinner or I'm going for a walk or whatever. And it's something that I can actually focus on, because you're right. So much content now, it's so predictable. I can't even keep my focus on it. Yeah. It's too boring. I'm like, oh, I know what's going to happen next. But if you listen to some of these true crime things and they walk you through it with like the cops on the case, they didn't know the answer. And so they're telling you, oh, we have this suspect and that suspect. And each one you're like, was it him? Was it him? And no, because if we're only 15 minutes in, of course it's not him.
Exactly. And I think that's why you're starting to see a proliferation of these things on streaming networks like Netflix, like Amazon. You're starting to see both. You're starting to see way more like love-based kind of reality shows, and you're seeing more of these kind of true crime sort of first 48-ish, you know, or actually you're seeing a lot of true crime in visual form where they're taking you through these crimes and you're just episode by episode being slowly walked through to whatever the conclusion is. And so I don't know I don't know if you ever watched this one. I feel like I'm going to cheat up for a second, just very quickly. There was something about like a cat, like, oh my gosh, this is going to kill me. And I don't want to waste a lot of your time. Viewership, love you guys. And so too, Leslie, I don't want to spend a lot of your time.
Now I have to know though, since there's a cat.
I know. Wait, hold on. The title definitely doesn't represent. You know what's funny? Someone somewhere is screaming the title to me right now. That's what I love about things like this, right? Someone somewhere knows it, and they're like, "It's whatever it is, you idiot!" And I'm like, "I don't know what it is. I'm going to spend time trying to figure it out." Let's see.
Is this Don't F with Cats?
Yes. Jesus. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I don't know why I could not get it, but you got it faster than me. So thank you so much. Don't F with Cats is literally a crime. Have you seen it?
No, but now I have to. I
have to see it. It's about an online community. I'm not going to spoil anything, guys. It's about an online community where a crime is committed and the person escalates from harming animals to now harming people. And this online community bands together to find this person, using obscure details like the building outside their window, the color of their couch, the type of flooring they have, like, and they start to then pinpoint and create this cat and mouse game with this person, because now the person is doing crimes to taunt them and to say, catch me, community, if you think you can. And so the title doesn't actually seem like it's that. It feels like it's kind of strange, but it's about a community that first started when this guy had an online, he became, I think, online, a viral moment for harming a cat. And it became a true crime where there was an actual death involved. So I don't want to give all the details away, but it's interesting, and it's told from the perspective of the police. and from the online sleuthers who came from a widespread community. So a lot of them are like super nerdy. A lot of them seem like super cool. Some are gothic. It's like a whole spread. They all just like form this community to catch a killer. And so if you're into true crime, check out Don't F with Cats. It didn't get, I think because of the name, it didn't get quite the attention that like a Dahmer would get or any of the other ones, but it's good indeed. It's good indeed.
Now I know what I'm doing the next time I can't sleep and need to watch something.
It is awesome. We're going to follow up with me. Email me after you see it, whenever that's
going to.
And tell me if you like it or not. All right, guys. Listen, I think we had a great conversation. I hope that you learned about customer trust, about building customer loyalty, about understanding your product, about understanding the type of business that you want to enter into. I hope you also learned that the stories that you hear about Amazon sellers and that their successes are really built on need, on either a need in the market or a need in their own personal life. So if you find that you're in a space of either, then maybe a marketplace is the space for you. If you don't know what to do, then you might come to a person like Leslie and Riverman and have a conversation and figure some things out. Because we all come to a moment where we have the capacity to be entrepreneurs, where we find a problem that we think we can solve. To me, that's what entrepreneurship is all about, finding a problem that you think you can solve in your life, in the life of your friends, family, right? And deciding then, do we undertake it? Do we improve on something that already exists? Do we create something new? Or do we provide equity? Do we provide more access to that thing in the market? However you go about it, whatever it is, understand that you can truly be an entrepreneur and exist in a marketplace. And that being an Amazon seller, not only, or whatever marketplace seller, not only benefits the lives of you and your family, but it benefits the lives of the buyer and whatever that buyer needed in that moment. And if you can provide that level of need to someone who needs it, I don't see anything greater to do with your time. I'm Dion Brown. This is Man Versus Brand. That's Lindsay Hensel. This is our episode. Guys, take a moment, go over, check out where she's at. Leslie, tell them where they can go if they want to know more about your consulting.
You can find us at riverbendconsulting.com. We also have a phone number on our website. We actually answer the phone. Rare to find that these days. And then if you head on over to LinkedIn and put in my name, Leslie Hensel, I have fresh new Amazon and e-commerce content almost every day of the week. I'd love to connect with you there.
All right. So you guys heard it. Stop right now. Pause this recording. Stop the video. Whatever you have to do, go over. Make sure you check out what Leslie's doing. She gave a lot of great, solid advice if you're interested in selling in almost any marketplace. And I think that the content that she's producing on her LinkedIn, what you'll find when you go to the consulting site, should lead you to a place where you can get a solid footing in the market and succeed. That's all everyone that's a guest on Man Versus Brand wants for you guys, is for you to succeed. I'm Dion Brown. That's Leslie. Thank you guys so much. Talk to you soon. Bye.
If this talk just resonated with you or could help someone you know, follow Dion or his guest on all social media platforms. Till next time. And remember, with any business or brand, give it your heart, make it real, or else forget about it. See you all soon.